I was very fast, and we were talking about the two POVM scenarios that we were considering. That's what we ended with. And of course, I was telling you about it's much better because it's a higher probability of success together with ability to distinguish. I mean, of course, defining probability of success is complicated in these cases. What do you mean by success? Let me just erase what I said and let's look at again the case we had. We had two cases, we had these two states. We had a case in which we had POVMs and which case in which we have PVM. In particular, a PVM that are based on a measurement of an observable on the first qubit. And we obtained that with this kind of, you can tell that those states are chosen to be eigenstates of two different observables of a qubit, right? This is an eigenstate of, if you want, Pauli operator, and this is an eigenstate of a different Pauli operator. And of course, if you measure one of them, one of the two Pauli operators, you can get that the probability of distinguishing the state when it's the state one is one. If you obtain a zero in the measurement is one. The probability of obtaining a one in this one is zero. The probability of obtaining a one with the state two, state one is zero, that's fine. Psi two is 1/2. Yeah, that's the PVM and the PVM. One with psi one, probability of obtaining a one, a zero, a one, there you go. One is, yeah, that's right, sorry. Probability of obtaining zero with this state is one, probability of obtaining one is zero, but then the other state, the probability of obtaining one or zero is 1/2 for both. So yeah, this method will be 100% successful when you start with zero, but then it really is completely ineffective in order to distinguish the other state. So if you obtain a measurement one, then you know is the state, but if you obtain a measurement zero, you cannot tell. Whereas in this case, in the case of the POVM, every time you obtain either outcome one or outcome two, you have two outcomes that are complementary, as in they're zero for the different states, and they're non-zero for the others. So anytime you obtain outcome one or two, you always distinguish the two. However, sometimes with probability one over root two, you're gonna get inconclusive results. And those inconclusive results, so that's the price you pay. The POVM can actually distinguish the two states, unlike this one, if you accept the possibility that you have inconclusive results. Make sense? Yeah.
So is there a systematic way for picking the E1 and E2?
Yeah.
What is that systematic?
If you notice, I pick one to be a combination. This one is a combination of, if you want, projectors that will give you different results on that state. This one, so the difference between the PVM and the POVM is that the PVM is like you're given an observable and you can do only PVMs. But if you notice the construction of the POVM that I did is like, well, I take one of the projectors for one of the observables. I take a projector for a different observable that doesn't commute with the first one. You see that, remember, I didn't write it here. Remember in your notes, E1, E2, and E3? E1 is kind of a projector over that one. E2 is kind of a projector over that one. Those are not orthogonal projectors, so you need to complement with an E3. That is a projection.
What is that kind of projector?
Well, you need to normalize that. There's no projectors, you see? You need to normalize them because they are non-orthogonal projectors.
Were they actually projectors of those, or were they like orthogonal to those states?
No, they're projectors over this state, projectors over this state. Kind of.
Because I'm trying to do the homework and I'm confused.
Let's look at them. But I shouldn't waste too much time on this. You see, look at that. The first one, right, is a projector over one. The second one is a projector over zero subtracting the one. And the third one is whatever the complement is missing.
But the first one was a projector, it was like 1, 1.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not 0, 0.
Well, you want something that gives you zero on that one. And then you want something that gives you zero on that one with the other outcome.
Oh, so it is kind of like orthogonal.
It is. It's the kind of the orthogonal complement. But not really, because there's also factors, right?
Yeah.
Because the whole thing needs to be normalized.
Okay.
Make sense? So the way to design it is, give me a projector that gives me zero on one of them. Give me a projector that gives me zero on the other. That's one way to design it.
And how does one normalize them? Because it doesn't seem...
Well, they need to add to identity. Remember the definition of POVM.
But wouldn't that be true? Like, as long as they're kind of like you know, not too big, and then you have...
That's right. You have infinitely many ways of choosing them. Choose the ones that maximize the probability of getting one or the other.
Oh.
Try to maximize what isn't here and minimize what isn't here.
Oh, that's kind of tricky. Can you do that systematically?
Yeah, you can. It's an optimization problem, right?
Okay.
Make sense? We can discuss more of that. If you're worried about doing homework, you don't need complicated things for the homework or tutorials. So we can talk more about it later on if you want. Yeah?
I just had a quick question. If all POVMs are non-normalized projectors, or
no.
Combinations of them?
You could be more general. I can get this PVM and combine it with something else as well to make a new PVM, POVM. And we will discuss more about what POVMs are, because we're going to discuss the problems of PVMs. You see, remember the definition of POVM. The definition of POVM is just give me the POVM elements. Any POVM elements that satisfy the properties that they're positive operators that can decompose the identity like that would actually give you a POVM formally. Okay? We will discuss the generality of POVMs. But yeah, they're very general. And basically, given an experiment, right, in the lab, when you design an experiment in the lab, you can always find a mathematical description of your experiment in terms of a POVM. Okay, associating outcomes to particular results. Make sense? And remember that PVMs are different from POVMs are different from PVMs in that we are messing only with the update rule. So what is important here is what happens to the state after the measurement. That's what we're focusing on. Make sense? All right. So another thing that I said wrong, and I realized when I crossed the door, I think I wrote that too. So this is, I have here a better version. Remember I told you a bit of a hand-wavy version of Steinspring theorem? This is a better, still a simplified version, but a better version of Steinspring theorem. So in particular, Steinspring theorem tells you that if you have a density operator on Hilbert space HA, and then you have at CPTP map something that maps positive operators, that O there is the set of positive operators on the Hilbert space, linear positive operators. Then the map that maps positive operators to positive operators of trace one, so density operators to density operators. Then there exists a Hilbert space, HIV, right, such that the channel or the positive operator, the CPTP map mapping row A to row prime, right, can be thought of as a unitary acting on a larger Hilbert space, on a pure state of a larger Hilbert space, where the dimension of the Hilbert space is actually larger than the square, not twice, which is what I said in the previous one, of the dimension of A. And that makes sense, right? Because what I meant is you need another copy of H. You need a Hilbert space as big as the previous one. And that's the square, of course. It's a tensor. The Hilbert space of a composite system is a tensor product of the individual Hilbert spaces. In particular, by the way, that means that you can think of any mixed state as the purification of a pure state.
Sorry, is that a completely base preserving?
No. See completely positive. This is dyslexia in action. Completely positive trace preserving. Sorry about that. A quantum channel. Make sense? Things that map physical states into physical states. Everybody happy with all that? All right. Now, before moving to PVMs and POVMs and the discussion from it, like after we've covered things that I said in the previous lecture, let me go back to one thing that I wanted to do and I moved. It's going to be very fast, hopefully, that I moved in order to cover POVMs first so you could do the tutorial on Thursday. We didn't see this, right? This is a protocol. We should have seen it before. There's a protocol that is called quantum teleportation that uses entanglement as a resource. How many of you have seen quantum teleportation somewhere? Hands up. Okay, everybody has seen it. Is that right? Everybody, you too? Okay, then we will be very fast, right? Quantum teleportation, you begin with, typically I do a small cartoon here, where you have step one, you start with A1 and A2. And B starts with this, right? And basically, one of the subsystems, in particular A1, is a particular system that B would like to have, but B is far away. So what A1 and A2 are doing, they're, well, A, let's say an agent A and an agent B. A does a joint measurement of these two systems in a basis that's non-local. In particular, here will be a Bell measurement. By that, it destroys completely the two states in the sense that it's a measurement, right? It's a, in fact, a projective measurement in this scenario. So it's destroying the state of these two states and generates two bits of information. These two bits of information are sent to Bob, and Bob now knows how to act, alpha being the outcome of the measurement. Then Bob knows how to act on the subsystem B to recover identically the state A1. The partial state of Bob becomes the state of A1, right? So imagine that Bob forgets his cat, and then Bob goes on a trip, and Bob wants the cat, and then what they have is like, well, in order to communicate, we're gonna both share a maximally entangled state with the same dimension. The partial systems have to have the same dimension of the cat, so the square root of the dimension of the Hilbert space of the cat, right? And then Alice says, oh, Bob says, oh, I miss my cat. Well, I can send it to you, I can teleport it to you. Then Alice gets the gas with a Hilbert space with the same dimension as the square root of the, well, at the actually the dimension of the Hilbert space of the cat. Then Alice makes a measurement on the cat at the same time as the gas. Alice completely destroys the cat and the gas, but generates a bunch of bits, and those bunch of bits can be sent to Bob, and then Bob now knows how to act on the gas that Bob has, right, in order to rearrange it to become the cat, or indistinguishable from the cat, rather. Make sense? All right, so I'll go fast because you've seen this. So you can tell that initially you start from an entangled state between Alice and Bob. That's what I call A2B3 here. Can you see it, all of you? All right, and then I have the state that I want to teleport, which is 0 plus 1, right, an arbitrary state, alpha 0 and alpha 1 being the coefficients of the elements of the basis. This is a qubit to simplify, so a bit smaller than a cat. Then Alice makes a Bell measurement and say that Alice, for example, obtains 5 plus. It doesn't matter. It obtains a Bell state. You know, the result would be either 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, or 1, 1, depending on what Bell state Alice measures when she measures jointly the state. So all that I did here is to rewrite the tripartite state A1, A2, B3 in terms of the Bell basis for A2, B3. This is just literally, right? The entangled state is a tensor product. And I wrote it in terms of tensor products of the two systems. There's nothing done here, but then here, this is factoring out the two qubits that Alice, right? But then of course Alice is going to make a measurement and it's going to obtain either phi plus, phi minus, psi plus, psi minus. So what we do now is we change basis to the Bell basis for A1, A2, because that's what the basis Alice is going to measure on. And as you can tell, the state, this is just a change of basis, so the state looks like this. The state looks like a superposition, of course, of all the Bell states, tensor with some state for Bob. Make sense? And now, of course, based on that state, you know that if Alice measures in the Bell basis, depending on what Alice obtained, right, is gonna be doing a projective measurement. We imagine that Alice can distinguish between all of them. So if Alice does a projective measurement on the Bell basis, Bob is going to end up with that state, with the thing in the parentheses, right? Depending on the outcome of the joint measurement. And then you get a little table here that tells you what operation Bob needs to apply, dependent of what A measured, right? The two bits of information that Alice received in order to recover the state that Alice wanted to send. Does that make sense, everybody? I'm going fast there, but you've already seen it. So there was this interview to Bennett one time, where Bennett was asked by a journalist, popular science journalist, oh, you clearly are teleporting the body of the thing, the mat, but you cannot teleport the soul, right? And then Bennett said something, no, I think you misunderstood. You don't teleport the body, you actually teleport only the soul, right? Because what you're doing is imbuing in a completely different system the properties of the first one, right? So it's, you really have killed the cat. Have you seen The Prestige? Any of you? I recommend it.
Yeah.
It's a movie. It's a great movie.
Awesome.
The Prestige. It's about magic, as in magicians, not magic as in fantasy. But there's a lot of fantasy too. But this thing is relevant. So yeah, watch The Prestige. It's a cool movie.
Wait, sorry. So this doesn't violate the the no cloning theorem just because you destroyed the first?
Correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You are not cloning anything here. Make sense, everybody? You're teleporting. If you can't tell, what you're teleporting is quantum information. You're teleporting information about A1 into B.
If Alice didn't call Bob to say, I got 0, 0, let's say
Bob cannot recover anything.
But if Bob assumes that, okay, I'm going to always assume she's getting 5 points.
The probability of success in this case is 1 over 4.
Yeah, so 25%, there's still a probability.
It's a freaking qubit. Imagine a cat. The probability of success is 1 over trillions of trillions of trillions.
Yeah.
So the bigger the system, if you want to send a bunch of qubits, the probability of success decreases exponentially with the volume of the Hilbert space.
The
number of qubits.
Like, what are the issues with scaling
with the volume.
To, like, the size of a cat?
The coherence, mainly. So the problem is that these are pure states. Mm-hmm. If you are a finite temperature, you don't have pure states. Your measurements are not projective. We're going to discuss that. Measurements are never projective measurements. Projective measurements are an idealization. It works sometimes it doesn't. All those things combined, and of course, maintaining the entanglement. I'm assuming that A and B have an entangled, maximal entangled state. Cool. If you reduce the ability of having any of those, then you reduce the fidelity of teleportation. So when you do it in a lab, you can get maybe a 90-something% of fidelity for one qubit. If you are really careful, and it's not a cat, it's something very cold, and it's like logical qubit, and so on. Then
do you use like quantum error correcting methods with the quantum teleportation?
You can, yeah.
Would you have
extra qubits, yeah, and that helps.
Let you like teleport more amounts of information.
Yep.
The most like information that people have teleported?
As far as I know, I'm a bit outdated on this, but big molecules have been teleported.
Wow.
The quantum state of big molecules, yeah.
That's fancy.
Yeah. It's not going to get much, much better than that. Or if you want, billions of photons, quote unquote, in polarization have been teleported to, if you want.
But
with errors, but then you discard part. Again, error correction. You actually have redundancy, typically, yeah.
When people talk about, like in science fiction, they say, okay, teleportation, like teleporting human being, like,
that's typically classical teleportation, not quantum teleportation.
What classical teleportation? I mean, you're talking about like getting on an airplane, going somewhere else?
No. Classical teleportation is getting all the data about your brain and your body as possible, and then reconstruct it again. Yeah, that's typical. I call it classical teleportation because I don't think there's much quantum information to teleport in a human being. Humans are very hot and very big. It's a debate you can have whether there's anything quantum about human beings. I don't think there is. But it's, of course, I don't have a proof. I can tell you, like, looking at the way the brain, at the operational temperature of the computer that we're running in a way that doesn't feel very quantum to me.
Okay, well, but that's weird.
Classical teleportation, it's easier than quantum teleportation. Because classical teleportation, in mind, I can classically teleport to you this sign. I can measure it, read it to you. Do not clean board. And then you copy it with that font and that size. I just need to tell you all the information. And you should be able to manipulate a system that you have there to imbue all that information there, right? So I feel that classical teleportation certainly is, the coherence is not a big of an issue. This is very fault tolerant to do it classically. So I don't think we need entanglement to do that. If we ever get to do classical teleportation, I don't think we need to spend entanglement. There's not that much quantum. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's a lot of quantum that we don't know yet. And we need really entanglement to recover a human being, but I doubt. Make sense?
That becomes philosophical, though. Comes for self or recover a human being.
But then you could clone people because there's like not a no cloning theory.
There is no cloning theory. You can clone people. Yeah. Yeah. What's the prestige? I recommend. And then we chat next week. The last day we can chat. I'm hoping that the last day we have time for a lot of discussion in general.
Maybe we should have been in the prerequisites.
You're right. Yeah. Next year we will fix that up. All right. Let's talk a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the measurement problem and the problems of PVMs. So you see, PVMs, POVMs, unless you're interested in things like quantum foundations or quantum information, are typically not that popular. If you start asking people that have user-level knowledge of quantum mechanics, unless they've taken a course in undergrad where they cover it, which is not uncommon, but you can genuinely graduate in physics, even mathematical physics, and not have heard about POVMs. Because in your quantum mechanics undergrad, it's very common to just model measurements as PVMs. Make sense?
Yeah.
Now, there are problems with PVMs. Let me write them. First one.
Sorry.
Yeah.
That was two times the dimension of H, correct?
No. It was a mistake in the previous day. Well, it makes sense, right? You need the square at least. And the reason is that you need a copy of the system. And let me tell you why I make that mistake. I'm working with Gaussian quantum mechanics. I was solving a problem in Gaussian quantum mechanics before coming here. That's phase-space representation for the, instead of representing states in a Hilbert space, you represent them as distribution in phase space. Things are much easier in the sense that you get a structure of direct sum instead of tensor product, and hence my issue with the two. It's a tensor product. So therefore, the dimension of the tensor product is the power, is the product of the dimensions of the two spaces. Make sense? Yeah, that was a mistake. That's why I recovered it here. That clear for everybody? All right. So PVMs distinguish two categories of physical systems. Measurement apparatuses and measured systems. So PVMs are telling you that there's some magical system that we call measurement apparatus that when you make it interact with your system, what it's doing is a projective measurement to update it. It's doing a projection. Does that make sense? That is very weird, because in general, well, projectors are certainly most projectors are not unitary. Agreed? Projectors are actually, they're self-adjoint operators, and most of them are not unitary. So I cannot really think of what a measurement apparatus is doing in general and some interaction with some Hamiltonian, my system with some Hamiltonian, with the measurement apparatus. In mind that I have a very closed system control, there's no environment, or I call apparatus, whatever gives me the classical bit of information, the classical information, plus the environment. I cannot think of that as some unitary interaction. Because again, yeah, projectors are not going to be unitary in general. So it's basically, when you tell me that what the system is undergoing when you do a measurement, if you tell me it's a projective measurement, you're telling me that there's a family of things in the universe that I call measurement apparatuses that give me classical values, but I cannot distinguish, I cannot describe it with quantum mechanics. It's inconsistent with the description of quantum mechanics that I've been given. Make sense? There's something that if you're just doing quantum mechanics and you don't care about relativity, you shouldn't care too much about. But there's, of course, the incompatibility. We should care because we are, you're getting a lot of courses, including QFT, right? And incompatibility with relativistic causality, right? If you assume that your state is being updated by a projective measurement and you have an entangled state, right? You're assuming that the state update, whenever it happens, is updating the Hilbert space of something that could be spatially separated, space-like separated. So you cannot really think of PVMs as describing a physical process, because if you were, you are actually assuming that you can do things that are incompatible with relativistic causality. Now, of course, you could say, well, within the limits of the approximation and so on, yeah, but that means that there's not every measurement can be actually modeled like that. Make sense? There's also another problem. Let me call it the problem of quantum to classical transition. Now, this is used in quantum foundations and quantum information in two different ways. Quantum to classical transition, you'll often hear that it refers to how macroscopic systems lose their quantum properties as you scale them up. That's one of the contexts of quantum to classical transition. Within the measurement problem, there's another notion of quantum to classical transition. I have a system that is described with a probability distribution, right? Say a pure state, a fully known state, pure state that is described with a probability distribution. And suddenly I make a measurement and the state is no longer described by a probability distribution. I have a number now, 42 or whatever I obtain. How did that happen? When did I lose the unpredictability of experiments? Suddenly it's predictable. How does that transition happen? You see, at some point, the experimentalist writes on a notepad or on a computer a number. At some point throughout the whole measurement process, the state has been updated, and now it's not a probability distribution. The outcomes of experiments are no longer probability distributed, of that observable, no longer probability distributed. Now they are completely predictable. How did that happen?
Is it while it's going after
that? No. This quantum to classical transition is used in two completely different contexts. The first one is the scaling up. And the other one is in the measurement problem. They're not the same.
Oh, but then within,
No. There are measurements that are not destructive. Stenger-Lach experiment, for example. Many measurements. Not all measurements. If your measurements are destructive, you don't care about the measurement problem. Born's rule is enough. You see? You don't need a state update. Imagine that you're in a universe where all measurements are destructive, then you don't care. But most of the time, you have to measure things many times, and you have things after you measure, right? Your system's still there. You haven't destroyed it.
Yeah.
Imagine you make a measurement on a quantum field. You don't destroy the quantum field, right? Make sense? People would say, oh, sometimes you destroy the photon, you observe it. What do you mean? The electromagnetic field is no longer there? You need to update the electromagnetic field if you do a localized measurement, no? That's not easy. How do you update it? See what I mean? Okay. Is that clear? Now, another thing that is clear is that, sure, there are some systems, right? There are some systems, some measurement apparatuses that are indeed very well described by PVMs, what they do. There are some simple ones. Again, a Stenger-Lach experiment, you would use a PVM and you would be okay. You would be predicting everything that's going on. It's not that PVMs cannot work to update states sometimes, but in general, they cannot. You know, the interaction of our measurement apparatus with the system cannot be described by a PVM. The result of it, the update rule, cannot be a PVM. It should be something else. Does that make sense? Sometimes you will find some privileged systems for which it works, but it cannot be the case when I have a complicated measurement system. Does that make sense? Now, let's go for a second to that theorem over there.
Sorry, I didn't understand the third point exactly. Not for the scaling up version.
Yeah.
You said when you do a measurement, not necessarily your state is not necessarily destroyed.
Yeah.
Do other measurements.
Sure.
What's the problem with that?
That's the update rule, right? How do you go from a state that was a superposition of two eigenvalues of the observable you're measuring to a state that is no longer a superposition? What happened there?
Oh.
At what point? Just by obtaining information about the system, see? All that I'm doing, I have an apparatus that does a projective measurement.
Isn't that the problem with any sort of measurement? Why should
it
be PVM?
It is a problem. Give me some, we'll see.
Okay.
It is a problem. And that's what leads to something called the Heisenberg cut, and we will talk about it in a second. So the problem here is, at what point does it happen that I acquire information about the system, and no matter how you see, the thing with measurements is no matter how I acquired it, the moment I have it, I know that compatibility with future measurements have to tell you that the result is the same as the previous one. If you do no matter how you do your measurement, pick your favorite method, but that method tells you that the result is 42, and the error is very small, then you know that any measurements that you do afterwards have to give you 42 with 100% probability immediately after the state update. When did that happen? What happened and when? You know, at what point? Is it when I acquire the information? Because how about two people that don't have the same information? How do they describe the state, right? I projected it, but maybe somebody else didn't see me project it. Should they describe the state with a density operator, classical distribution? Should they describe it with a pure state? At what point should, you see, that is really, really fundamental. At what point should I stop describing the system as, let me write it like that. Imagine you have the simplest one, right? 0 plus 1. Can you measure the poly observable that has eigenvectors 0 and 1? There are two people. You make a projective measurement. And any outcome of the measurement right after, mind you, get a 0, right? Any outcome of the measurement afterwards has to be a 0 when you measure the same observable. But that's the point. At what point did I change from that to that? Is it when I acted with the measurement apparatus? Is it when I acquired the information? What if it's a different apparatus? How come that completely different experiments can actually give me the same like that? What about other person that didn't see me do the measurement? Should they update it? What if that person is space-like separated from me? Should they update it? See what I mean? Aha, very good. So you see, it's non-trivial. Somebody did like that, and indeed. You see, so putting update rules on top of quantum mechanics is difficult, and in this problem in particular is, okay, at what point do I go from that, and then I obtain a value, right, say a value 0, classical information, and what point in this whole process should I update, and for whom? So I got a, I call it quantum to classical, because this is a quantum superposition of two eigenstates, and now I don't have it. I have something that, for that observable, I can describe classically, something that has a definite outcome of all measurements on that observable. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. When does that happen and how? All right. So these are problems of PVM. I'm not saying that POVMs are free of problems. I'm saying that PVMs have those problems. Make sense? Now, let me write this theorem. So this theorem is the counterpart, if you want, of Steinspring theorem. It's also a dilation theorem, but it's about measurements. Again, hand wavy version in a way. Those theorems are long to write and to get the conclusions otherwise. All right. The unitary evolution of a couple system detector environment target consider that I am in a lab and I have a target system I want to measure, a quantum system, right? Then I have a measurement apparatus that's also a quantum system. Like assumption here, everything is a quantum system. That's the assumption we're going to make here. So we have the system, target system, the measurement apparatus, and everything else in the lab, the environment. Okay? We have these three things. If everything is describable within quantum mechanics, then there should be some unitary operation that implements time evolution. There should be some interaction, Hamiltonian if you want, between your apparatus and your system and the environment. That makes sense? The environment, you can think of it as the purification of the detector system, of the detector target system. All right? So that's all there is. So if we believe that quantum mechanics should be able to describe measurement apparatuses as well, then and environments, right? Then there should be some unitary evolution coupling the three. Make sense? Everybody? Okay. The action of a PVM on the detector always yields. Have you done this already in the tutorial? I know that in one of the tutorials you proved this. I don't know if it was I think it should have been the tutorial on Thursday. The action of a PVM on the detector always yields a POVM on the target. Okay, let's analyze the theorem. I don't know if you've seen. This is a theorem that you are proving one way or another, either this week or last week. I don't remember. If you don't remember, haven't done it, then it's this week. I just don't have it on the top of my head. I'm not going to prove it, but I think this statement is powerful enough to require proof, and you're going to do it. It's not difficult to prove it. It's just long. Do we understand the theorem? The theorem tells you that, okay, if I couple unitarily a detector environment target system, and then I do a PVM on the detector, then the outcome on the target, the update on the target, will be the induced update on the target. When I do a projective measurement on the full system after this is coupled, it's a POVM. That's the math. Do we understand the math?
I'm sorry, the target, like the state?
The target is what you want to measure. The three things are a quantum system. Detector, measurement apparatus. Target, what you want to measure. Environment, everything else.
Okay.
Make sense? So what this tells you is that if you have a detector and a target, and I want to couple the detector to the target, and of course, the two things would couple to an environment, perhaps, then I know that if I do, after the measurement, do a PVM, projective measurement on the detector, the update rule, the effective update rule after I project on the big Hilbert space, the update rule on the target is always a POVM. Let's interpret what's going on. This is much more powerful than PVMs for the next reason. I'm not going to say that I can do projective measurements on anything, on the things that I'm measuring. I'm going to say that I have a privileged family of quantum systems that I'm going to call detectors. Detectors should have the following characteristic. They couple to the system that you want to measure, and you should be able to describe measurements on the detectors as PVMs to a very reasonable degree of approximation. You say, this is way more modest. With projective measurements, you're always saying, all that I can do to a system is a measurement that gives me some information, then I project. I'm saying, no, all that I can do to a system is coupling it to a detector. And then I don't touch the system anymore. Now I measure the detector. I look at the detector and it's a 7 on the screen of the detector, not on the system, see? I'm saying that there are privileged families of systems, of quantum systems that I call detectors, for which PVMs are okay descriptions for measurements. Okay updates for measurements. Does that make sense, what I'm saying there? Before you think about it, no, it's not solving the problem, but it's so much better. You see what I mean? It's so much better because I'm saying PVMs just work with a restricted, the Stenger-Lach experiment. I know, for example, that the orientation of the magnets is a big wheel, that I can do that. And I'm assuming that a projective measurement on the angle of the wheel, it's an okay description. But not on the electron, I'm doing nothing on the electron. The electron is just coupled unitarily to that wheel and the environment. That makes sense? So I've removed one of the problems, which is, well, in fact, more than one, but I removed one of the problems, which is I no longer distinguish two categories of physical systems. They're all describable by quantum mechanics. Before, measurement apparatuses would not be describable within quantum mechanics. Now they are. They are special, though. The special part of them is that I can do a PVM on them, and it's an okay description on the measurement apparatuses, right? In fact, I'm telling you how to choose lab equipment. When you want to choose lab equipment, better do one for which PVMs work. That makes sense. And that could be, you know, the experiment happens, and there's a screen in the measurement apparatus that tells you 6. And acquiring that information, you update the state of the measurement apparatus with a PVM, and that's fine. Make sense? Could be very macroscopic, like a screen or a big wheel. Right. You also have solved this as long as your interaction is relativistic, as long as it's QFT. So if the interaction between everything that you have, your measurement apparatus and your system, it's given by a quantum field theory, there should be no problem in the interaction itself. The update, the unitary update, is respecting the laws of relativity in the sense, well, I mean, it comes from a microcausal theory. It's not going to be able, something that happens here, it's not going to be able to affect somewhere else. Make sense? So if your unitary is given by a relativistic theory, for sure you don't have problems with causality. We will discuss it. Now, the third problem is the quantum to classical transition. Have I solved it? Almost. The reason is that, what do you mean by almost? Well, the reason is that, right, there's no such transition. The transition now happens, whatever the magical process that goes from a quantum state to a number and then suddenly and something that's not quantum, the information, when you acquire the information, that happens at the level of the measurement apparatus, not the system. See what I mean? The system is interacting unitarily. The systems get entangled, in fact, gets entangled with the measurement apparatus. And it's that entanglement that actually yields the coherence in the system. So you can think of the updates, right, as the coherence inducing the system through the interaction. Now, of course, you have just shifted the burden of it to the detector. See what I mean? Now, okay, but how the detector is also a quantum system. how come that I can actually update it with a PVM and go from a probability distribution to something that is a classical probability distribution now? See what I mean? So the problem of quantum to classical transition in the measurement problem has been shifted to the measurement apparatus. Well, of course, you can do the same again. How do you measure the measurement apparatus? Well, you couple something to it unitarily as well, right? For example, how do I read the screen? Well, you couple the electromagnetic field to the screen, and then the radiation gets to your eyes. So now the problem is in the radiation. Yeah, but the radiation has to be measured. How is it measured? Well, it gets to your eyes, and it interacts with your retinas. So your retinas are also quantum systems. And then at some point, there's a PVM that you need to do, right? At some point, something needs to be done a PVM. But what? You can raise the, that's called the Heisenberg cuts. This is called the Heisenberg. At what point do I consider that I am extracting classical information? See what I mean? The moment you extract classical information from something is when you're applying the PVM to update. But you can always dilate it. You see what I mean? I'm dilating it. Oh, yeah, but my detector is also a quantum. That wheel is actually a quantum system. Sure, maybe it's not the wheel. You need to measure it, measure the angle. How do you do it? It mechanically couples to the wall. OK, but then the wall is the one that you do in the PVM. No, but that's also a quantum system. How do you measure the wall to know that it's there as well? Well, I mean, you couple the molecules of gas. You couple the electromagnetic field. But how do you measure the electromagnetic field? You couple your eyes. You couple a camera. You know what I mean? It doesn't solve the measurement problem. It's still an open problem. But it actually gives rise to many interpretations of quantum mechanics. There's something called, I don't know, do you discuss interpretations of quantum mechanics in foundations? Have you discussed the ensemble interpretation? Valentine's interpretation? It's not as popular, but it's which one is your favorite interpretation, if you have one? Many worlds? Now, if you like many, you don't like many worlds?
I have problems, but they're just my problems.
Fair enough, fair enough. The many world interpretation is the most popular today, nowadays. Now, Valentine's interpretation, Valentine's ensemble interpretation is, I like it because it's super clean. Most people, also because it gets everybody mad when they hear it, as in, it's not true, that can be. You know what I mean? I don't want to speak for Valentine. I'm gonna, again, abuse it a little bit. Valentine tells you, there is no such thing as single outcome experiments. Single shot experiments are not physics. Reality, this is an illusion of us being human. Reality only appears, physical reality only appears when you do ensembles of experiments. That's why it's called ensemble interpretation. It's telling you, well, in physics, you never accept a result if you see it only once. You need to see it many times and have some certainty that the result is physical by repetition. So Valentine tells you, perhaps all that exists is ensembles, probability distributions over outcomes of measurements. If you admit that, you solve the measurement problem. And how? Because you say, well, yeah, my system, it's coupling to a larger system, say a detector system, right, and an environment, and it's getting entangled with it. By getting entangled with it, my system is losing coherence in a given basis. The basis that I'm measuring, actually, is losing coherence by getting entangled, entanglement. When you lose coherence, what's going on? So if I have, say, a state like that, right, consider something like that. When you lose coherence, you actually can prove this is a result in open quantum systems, very similar. You interact with something associated with measuring, coupling an observable that is the one in which you're expressing the matrix elements in that basis. These elements go exponentially to zero. That's called a coherence. And what you're left with is a classical, if you kill the diagonal elements of the density matrix, you are left with a classical probability distribution over quantum states, over pure states. So the measurement problem would be solved by that, saying that yeah, you end up with that. You don't really end up, there's no point in which you end up with a 42. You would repeat the experiment many times and you get a probability distribution over classical values when you do the experiment. So by admitting that there's no such thing as single shot experiments, you can explain the measurement problem away by saying it's just the coherence. Yeah.
It's 42, and then you measure it over and over and over, and each time it's 42.
This is not many times in time, it's many identical experiments. Instead of one measure many times, you have a million running parallel and you measure many labs.
Why would?
Because that's how we do science. In particle physics, you don't declare that you found a new excitation or a new model unless you can repeat and you have five or six sigma of certainty. That's an ensemble, you see?
I guess so.
There's no experiment in physics. There was a claim one that somebody measured a magnetic monopole, but only once. Nobody took it seriously. See what I mean? Like, some people took it seriously, but then they couldn't find it again, and then we stopped taking it seriously, you see? Ballantyne would tell you, no, in physics, maybe, I don't know, I'm extrapolating Ballantyne. Maybe this is your problem as humans, that you give too much importance to single-shot experiments. Maybe single-shot experiments are not elements of physical reality. Maybe what is elements of physical reality is ensemble behaviors. And we have a prejudice in our brains that make us think of single-shot experiments. Nobody likes this typically, because people say, but I can't do a single-shot experiment. Sure, Ballantyne would tell you that, yeah. And then these same people, I like many worlds, right? But these same people typically are, no, I prefer to believe that there's an infinite many number of universes and I understand the superposition principle as amplitudes over those. Really? You think that's intellectually honest to say that Ballantyne cannot be okay and that can be okay? See what I mean? Like the amount of extra stuff that you need to be assuming? I don't know. You see, I like Ballantyne because it's very self-consistent. It's not my if you ask me what's my favorite interpretation, it would be those two. And it's interesting. Many people would say they're very contrary. They're actually very similar. It's how you interpret the probability distribution only. Anyway, just wanted to tell you a little bit about the ensemble interpretation of quantum mechanics. Paul Ballantyne came once before my time to the equivalent to the PSI course, something like the PSI course, the grad students here. And he was yelled at, I don't know, because of explaining that. You see what I mean? Like, people get mad. I've seen it. Also, he's very provocative when he explains it. People get mad.
I must have missed something in the ensemble interpretation. So
yep.
If Ballantyne measures something and it's the result of the measurement is 42.
Yep.
And then it measures it again and again and again. It's still 42.
Yep.
It says that, well, it doesn't matter. You have to do it with other different.
Correct. Other labs have to do the same. My own experience is not enough to call it a physical phenomenon. It would tell you.
But what if you give that particular state to another lab and say, okay, do the experiment yourself?
But you need the initial state. So that's one experiment, what you're talking about. One experiment where you get one system and then you move it around. This is different. Ballantyne would tell you, no, do many experiments where you get the systems and move them around. And then you end up with a density matrix, and that's fine.
But isn't that diluting the problem? I mean, because...
If you assume that what is physical is just the density matrix that you get when you have an ensemble of experiments, no. Doesn't dilute.
So the thing that you see right now, the 42 that you see, that's not a physical...
No. That's right. That's right.
That's weird.
You see, that's why people get mad. It's weird in the sense that, but that's not that weird, meaning like, okay, if you see a part of the reality, maybe you are prejudiced by what you're seeing, and then you want to induce. Here's the experimental, if you want, ambition. I see a part of a physical system, and I prefer that I know everything about how the laws of physics work. That's what Ballantyne would tell you, as in like, how do you know that the laws of physics here are the same as in Pluto? If you haven't done all the experiments here as in Pluto, technically there's intellectual room for them to be different. So Ballantyne is telling you, in reality, you would have to do all those experiments, but the more you do, the better you get, the closer you get to what you want to describe, or the more certain you are. But then again, if you do many, you have an ensemble, then you have a density operator, and then you explain away the Heisenberg cut problem. The Heisenberg cut problem is just the coherence in your ensemble. Again, you may or may not like it. It's interpretation.
It still makes more sense than in many worlds.
Okay. Ah, there you go. You see? That's not that common at PSI, I would say, to think that. I consider them, you cannot attack one and not the other, I feel. All right, cool. So I want to end the measurement lecture with a little bit of a discussion of the measurement problem in QFT, because it's a PSI course. Okay, we already said that, right? I mean, it's still an open problem, so that's the disclaimer. You know that you have the Heisenberg cut, and what do you do with the Heisenberg cut? At what point are you really getting classical information about a system, and therefore something gets projectively updated, some detector system or super detector system, whatever you want to call it. But it is, I'm going to give you proposals, and you tell me if you see something unreasonable, okay? Proposal, at least some measurements can give values. That's pretty okay, a proposal, no? For example, 42, right? Then we can write those values on a notepad. Very classical information, right? In quantum mechanics, we idealize that with idealized measurements, PVMs. Make sense? When you actually obtain a measurement that gives a value, and you're pretty sure that that's the value, you update the state with PVMs. Now, basically, that's the description of what a PVM is. And then, of course, the problems that I mentioned. Here's the thing, you can just not care. If you do something applied, if you do quantum information for Xanadu, quantum computing, you may not care. Look, I know that a PVM is an okay description for what I'm doing, I just do it. And then I solve problems and I get rich. See what I mean? You can just not care. And that's fine. But still an open problem. All right, how about QFT? Now, again, maybe you want to measure localized observables of the field. For example, think of the electric field in this room during the direction of this talk, right? So I want to make a measurement that is localized in space-time of a quantum field, like the electric field here. And it's not unthinkable that I can get a result. Maybe I have a machine that's measuring the electric field, right, and gives me 42 volts per meter, which is the right order of magnitude. Make sense? That's the question that we want to ask now. Is it worse? Is it the same bad, or is it worse in QFT? All righty. Here's somebody from PI that opened the doors to this problem. It's really cool. The abstract, I don't think we should concentrate much on reading the abstract, given the time, but because the abstract has two parts. I will explain what the paper does. But I love the title, Impossible Measurements on Quantum Fields. Let's see. Sorkin does two things in that paper. Rafael Sorkin is, I see him around, so he still comes here. Rafael Sorkin, you can talk with him about this. He has his own opinions as well, and it's very, very nice to discuss with him. He does two things. First, there's a qubit system as an example, and he says, consider some state that is like that, 0i, 0b, then perform a local unitary on A. Then make an idealized Bell measurement projecting onto that, a PVM projecting onto that, and then he shows that the expectation of an observable on B gets information about the unitary on A. Surprise? No. Well, I don't know, but there's reason not to be surprised here. Because you're violating locality here, right? In the sense that you are allowed to do something that acts simultaneously on A and B, right? And this is what enables the transmission of information of something you did on A. If you only do the unitary, the partial state of B obviously will contain no information about that unitary. But if you do something non-local in between, then of course it will. That's okay in quantum mechanics. Make sense, everybody? Now he considers a quantum field. And he says, all right, I do a local unitary on this region of space-time on the field. Then I do a projective measurement. And actually, Sorkin does a projective measurement on a slice of space-time, which makes sense, you see. You're measuring the field. We will discuss about that, the localization. It makes a projective measurement. And then he says, and then I can prove that observables on B gain information about the unitary operation made on A. Make sense? That's what he proves. OK, is that understood? Any questions about that?
Sorry, what was P again?
Projective measurement.
Oh, OK. So you do a projective measurement on A, and then B, that is space-like separated, gains information.
What is A, right?
Yeah.
So A, what I have here, I'm talking, think of it from the point of view, thinking of states for QFT could be very misleading. So think of algebras of observables, rather. I'm making a unitary here that acts locally, is the exponential, or the complex exponential, of some localized observable of the field here, right? Some unitary operation. Then I do a projective measurement of the field here, and Sorkin decides to choose a strip of the field. I'm like, well, kind of makes sense to do a projective measurement on a full Cauchy surface. I'm measuring the field. And then he proves that B, now, the local observables of B, the expectation value of local observables on B will have information about what happened in A, even though they're space-like separated. That makes sense, yeah?
Aren't you assuming that they're doing simultaneous measurements at every time slice on B?
That's what you're assuming on P, right?
Yeah.
On P. Think of one slice. You are. Very important, yeah.
How would one do that?
That's the problem. How do you not do that? So we will discuss that. Yeah. So Sorkin is assuming that for that. Doesn't give much explanation as to why, but assuming that. So this led to two possible responses to that. This is when I was doing my PhD thesis, by the way. When that paper, 1992 was not when I was doing it, but this was very unknown. This paper actually flew under the radar. until the 2000s, late 2000s, which is when I was starting my PhD thesis. I finished in 2012, so that about that time. There are two. There was a paper on archive that I love, by the way. It doesn't contain much. It's very short. Faye Dauker. Faye Dauker is amazing. She comes here very often. Faye Dauker put a note out that said, it's called Useless Qubits in Relativistic Quantum Information. And she said, I'm pointing out the Sorkin paper, basically. Say, like, some people in relativistic quantum information are assuming that you can do these kinds of things, or very equivalent, and you can't. How do you do measurements in QFT? And when I read that paper, many people were shocked. And there were two ways in which people went out. I did more like that to model measurements, and we will discuss that. There's more things, but at the time, there was these two things. There's a third one that is done by Chris Fuster in York University, an algebraic approach, which is super cool, and I like it. Some people went this way. Even I wrote a paper, a couple of these things, localized idealized measurements. Is that okay? So that goes with you. Like, well, but you're doing a projective measurement on a strip, right? That's obviously the problem. I mean, come on. How do you do that? Can we solve this by disallowing two non-local kinds of measurements? All right. If you naively, if you read Sorkin, it may look like, right? That's the first thing you probably thought. You're doing a projective measurement on a full strip. Oh, I don't have it. Oh, here. Yeah, something. What about something like this? You are allowed to do a measurement that is localized, right? And it, what about the localization? That's a paper, by the way, that looks at that problem. What happens when you don't have projective measurements over the whole strip? And it's nice because it's called Impossible Measurements Revisited. And those are cool people, all of them, the three of them. I recommend their literature if you're interested in that. Anyway, let's go back to the problem. Why doing it on the strip on a full space-like surface is what Sorkin did. There's this old paper by Michael Redhead. It's called More Ado About Nothing. It's cool. It's about the Riggs-Leder theorem and the structure of the vacuum entanglement in a QFT, right? Even a simple one. But let's read this. Well, it's kind of cool to read. It's not going to solve the problem. I'm going to give you theorem one or theorem two. I think theorem one of that paper. So in this paper, questions about vacuum fluctuations in local measurements and the correlations between such fluctuations are discussed. It is shown that maximal correlations always exist between suitably chosen local projection operators associated with space-like separated regions of spacetime. However far apart these regions may be, the connection of this result with the well-known Ferragamo bound showing exponential decays of correlation with distance is explained. And the relevance of the discussion to the question, and I love this, that's why I like the abstract, what do particle detectors detect, is addressed. Because when you start looking formally at measuring local observables of the field, you realize that that cannot be that. Okay, what? All the particle physics intuition is completely incompatible and utterly incompatible with localized measurements of quantum fields. So that was kind of the beginning of, we've learned a lot since then, by the way. But that was kind of the beginning of questioning all that. And by the way, yeah, there is entanglement in, as you all know, probably because you've taken courses on things like this. And people talk about Rindler wedges and entanglement and thermal field duals and things like that all the time, no? So you know that there's entanglement in the ground state of QFT in flat spacetime, no? Minkowski vacuum. Theorem one of the paper. Oof, look at the theorem. Well, we'll just read the theorem. If P is an element of the local algebra of observables, that R of O is the local algebra of observables on a localized region of spacetime O. If P belongs to the set that is the local algebra of observables in a region of spacetime O, then P is an infinite dimensional projector. So if a projector is within a localized projector, has to be infinite rank. That is very incompatible with getting a 42. See what I mean? We'd get it a definite value. If you get a definite value, you may want to have a rank one projector or something close to a rank one projector. The only way you can have a rank one projector is if the region is the hollow spacetime. You project over a plane wave, for example. That's a rank one projector. And you have problems with that too. But you see what I mean? There's no way to have a rank one projector in QFT for a localized region of spacetime. The proof is kind of cool. I'm not going to go through, but the proof is kind of cool because it talks about the fact that for the two wedges, you can prove they're like type 3 factors, which is von Neumann type 3 factors. And that means they're infinite rank already. And they say, well, any because of one of the axioms of QFT any of the isotony action, right? Any of the elements of the local algebra of a localized region can be contained in a wedge, and therefore has to be a type 3 factor. That's more or less a sketch of the proof. That makes sense? All righty. So a PVM over a bounded region of spacetime cannot be finite rank, and therefore cannot model an idealized measurement. So what do you do? Well, you want, this is, we don't have the time to discuss that, but I was going to tell you my own view on how, what are well-modeled measurements in QFT. And I was going to argue that you should have these four characteristics. This is something I demand. If you disagree, right? It should be capable of producing definite values, because we see that in life. It should be able to provide an update rule that is compatible with relativity. And it should reproduce experiments. So the way I typically did it, there are more than one. See, for example, I can tell you a bit too about what Chris Fuster did, but I use particle detectors. What are particle detector models? Particle detectors are systems that are whose internal degrees of freedom are non-relativistic. What do I mean by that? Think of atoms, right? Hydrogen atom. It's a good approximation to use non-relativistic description for a hydrogen atom, right? And then it couples to the electromagnetic field. The atom can undergo relativistic trajectories, no problem. And the atom couples locally to the field. So the nice thing on that is that now the detector couples to the field, gets entangled with the field, all that stuff. Now I can do PVMs on the detector because the detector is non-relativistic. So I assume that my atom, I can measure, which in the lab people do, I can measure the electron in the hydrogen atom, where is it? I have methods to measure that very well, right? So the idea here is that you can do PVMs on the detector, and then you can wonder, okay, what are the POVMs induced on the field based on measuring the detector? And you can prove that if you're clever about it, you can find, if you're clever about it, meaning there's some rules to establish there, but you can have a full measurement theory for QFT that is respectful of relativity based on coupling things that are non-relativistic to the field and measuring those things. Keep in mind, how do we measure quantum fields? We always couple non-relativistic systems to those fields to measure. There's no such thing as measuring a localized observable of a field in any way that is not coupling something to it, for which the non-relativistic approximation works. In the end, all the measurements at LHC are solid-state sensors. In the end, all the measurements of the electromagnetic field end up in our eyes somehow. See what I mean? Like, there's always non-relativistic systems coupling to the field. Now, you can wonder if the fact that it's internally non-relativistic may mess up the theory. There's lengthy literature on that. It's part of my lines of research to see how non-local a measurement is if you use particle detectors. You know that if the detectors are approximately point-like, they're local, they're macrocosal and local. It's a field theory, if you want. If you have atoms for real that have a finite volume, factoring in that, how does that affect the causality of the theory, and if it is okay to do it? Again, that's part of one of my lines of research, working on that. There are other lines. For example, Chris Fuster, and Max Rueb is a former student of Chris Fuster. I think he graduated already. Maybe not. Well, either a last-stage PhD student or a ex-PhD student of Chris Fuster, what they do is they consider coupled field theories in regions of space-time. They have a system theory and a probed, detector field theory and a probe field theory. And they interact only in a finite region of space-time. And they describe induced observables, right? Observables on the detector field theory that depend on observables of the measured theory. The premise with that is that everything is a field theory. Your atoms are just an approximation to a field theory, so you would do a field theory in reality. Problem with that, they're both field theories. You need to measure the detector field theory, right, in the end. If both are field theories, you will have the same problems. What does it mean to make a measurement on the detector field theory? So the assumption is that somebody, somewhere, has the power to do measurements and on that other field theory. How? Well, I don't know. And the thing is that, well, atoms, in a way, ideally, atoms should be recovered from that, right? When you have interacting theories with potentials and so on. But that is tough. We don't know how to solve that. So The Feuster approach is very clean, it's very relativistic, all of it. There's nothing internally non-relativistic, but there is no way of easily describing it. And you still have the problem of how do you measure the measurement apparatus, right? The field that is the measurement apparatus. Particle detectors are not devoid of problems. Of course, when they're delocalized, right? Again, you have some degree of non-locality that you need to analyze the covariance of and so on. I can show you, and I just to publicize a bit Oh, you see, so XPSI students like Thales, Rick, and Bruno that were that you most of you know, we've been doing this. And then another PhD student of mine, Jose de Ramon, Maria Papagiorgiou, another XPSI student. We've been looking at that. So what happens? How does the detector play, a non-relativist detector play with relativity? What about general covariance? What about signaling, FTL signaling? There's a new paper that's coming soon, hopefully, same authors as well. But the point is, this is something, a bit of a long discussion, but the fact that it's capable of giving an update rule, you can check, I don't have it here, which is very sad. Let me just connect to Wi-Fi, and that's the last thing I show you. You can check that. Polo. Here. Yeah, if you want, there's a summary of all that you need in this paper, if you're interested. So this is, we make all our claims in there. You can build a measurement theory based on particle detectors. And I would argue that there is. And we say how to update the state in a way that is covariant, in a way that is compatible with relativity, not FTL signaling, not retrocausality. Anyway, I don't know. This is as much time as we have because the next day we need to begin quantum computing. And we're going to begin that because that is something that I really want to go through. So the connection with foundations, I think we'll probably stop much a lot along the lines here because we have two more topics, right, in a way. We have quantum computing, quantum gates and algorithms and quantum computing, and we have quantum cryptography. Those are the two things that are left. We also have the quantum ethics discussion next Monday. And we also have, I want to have some room for a deeper discussion on topics, right? I would also want to do QET. So if I end up having no time to do QET, I'll do QET informally at a different time for those of you who want, because I love QET. Does that make sense? So this is the end of the measurement issue. I wish I had 2 hours to talk about this, but I hope that the message is clear that the measurement problem in QFT is more complicated than in quantum mechanics. And not only more complicated because it gets more complicated, it's because you cannot really use PVMs ever in your life in QFT. And notice that people use them. People say, I have a photon, and I measure the polarization here, and I update it. And I update the state by a projective measurement. You can't really do that. You better are in a regime where you don't care anything about relativity. And your photons are just non-relativistic in the sense of, what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is you don't care about anything relativistic, just a support for your logical qubit, and you don't care. And anything that you do, better your experiment lasts longer than any light crossing time of the things that you're considering. Because, yeah, measurements that actually give you a definite value of a localized observer of the field can only be very non-local, as Sorkin told us, or didn't, but implied. That makes sense? Every time that you get a definite value of a localized role of the field, you are measuring something completely localized, hence non-physical.